Put a $20 bill. Not anymore, you're right. I'm going to put a $20 bill in the middle of the napkin. It's so much easier with an envelope.
You want a lighter?
What? So let me offer you this. Huh? Don't reach for it yet. You haven't got it yet. How much would you pay for this with this napkin for a $20 bill in it?
$20.
First rule in valuation. If you pay $20 for a napkin with $20 in it, what do you end up with? A napkin. So let me try this again. There's $20 in there. We all saw it going. So I'm not a magician now, because then you can do sleight of hand. How much would you pay for it? Start at a dollar. And then move up. So first rule in valuation is, you know the value of something, don't start your bidding at that number. You don't know what disease I have. Maybe I can't read numbers. Of course, that's unlikely, because if I open this up to bidding, at the end of the bidding war, I'll wager that we're going to end up roughly close to $20. It's a very transparent asset. Now let's make this interesting. I'm going to write a word on this envelope, or not, on this napkin. Can you tell me what that says?
Control.
Now it's a napkin with $20 and control on it. How much should you pay for this now?
$5.
It's already at 20. You can't push the price down. So you can go up from 20, stay at 20, or... No.
25. I pay 30. It's a napkin with the autograph.
Not quite, right? So let's assume you pay 25. Why? It's control in there, right? And I did this actually as an experiment at the Goldman Sachs bankers session a few weeks ago. I had an envelope. I put a $20 bill, and then I wrote a 3x5 card with the word control, and I put it in the envelope. I offered to the banker. You know what the M&A rule book says, right? What do you pay for control? A 20% premium. So this guy decides he's going to be clever. He offered me $24. You know what I did? I sold him the envelope. He said, I mean it. Hey, you offered me $24, and if you pay $24, what exactly did you get? You paid $4 for a 3x5 card with the word control on it. You can already see how this game played out. Then I wrote the word synergy on another 3x5 card. I put it in. How much did you pay for it now? Oh, still only 20, but synergy. How about brand name? You're a marketing person. You're doing somersaults in the air, right? But it's all 3x5 cards with words on them. You see where I'm going to go next? I'm going to state a proposition that it's the core of how I think about value. Let me give this back to you before I forget. You can keep the napkin if you want. It's called the IT proposition. You know what the IT proposition says? If it does not affect the cash flows and it does not affect risk, it cannot affect value. What's it? Control, synergy, branding. They're all words. If you want to pay for control, what exactly is the value of control? That you think you can run a business better than the existing guys, right? Strip down to basics, that's the value of control. So to value control, what do I need to do? Value the company twice. Once with the existing guys running the company, and once with you running the company, presumably the changes you make. And if you are right about the value of control, the value you get from running the company differently will be higher than the value of that difference is the value of control. This isn't rocket science. But if you have a company that's already perfectly managed and perfectly run, what's the value of control? Nothing. If it's a badly managed, badly run company, it could be huge. So the IT proposition says, don't pay for buzzwords. And we do all the time. Brand name, let me pay a 30% premium. I remember being at Coca-Cola about 10 years ago, and I valued the company, and I finished the valuation. This is for the top management team. And head honcho in the front row, marketing guru for Coca-Cola, puts up his hand and says, you forgot something very important. I forget a whole business. I said, what did I forget? He said, he forgot the fact that Coca-Cola is the most valuable brand name in the world. I said, what exactly do you want me to do? He said, you should add at least a 25% premium to your value. And I said, why? He said, because that's what we do in Coca-Cola, is when we buy brand name companies in other countries, we value it, and then we add 25%. He said, just because you do stupid things doesn't mean I have to do stupid things as well. What's the power of a brand name?
Consumer pricing.
basically you get to charge a higher price for exactly the same product. Think about it. That's the purest form of brand name. Take a look at Bayer aspirin and generic aspirin. It bottles next to each other in the store, right? Take a look at the ingredients in case you're suspicious. It is the same thing. Think of how many times you reach for the brand name.
But there is more complexity to that, though.
Not on the Bayer aspirin. On names where there's other stuff going on, there could be. Bayer aspirin, Sudafed, basically you're talking about the same thing.
Except for Sudafed will get better distribution to further retailers.
No, no, but I'm talking at CVS. I'm talking the consumer level. I'm not talking about the top down. So we can talk about other advantages you bring in, but I'm saying at the level of, that's the power of a brand name to me, is that you get pricing power, which shows up as higher margins, better distribution systems, maybe even lower costs of debt, because the bank says you're a brand name company. So you know what? To value brand name, I'm going to bring in all those things and say it's already in there. That's the edge proposition. So the next time you're sitting across a table and somebody says brand name, control, synergy, don't let them get away with it. Force them out of those buzzwords and say, let's put numbers.
So the goodwill line,
yep.
Should we get rid of it?
I ignore it.
But the market doesn't.
Does it? I'll give you an example of why I think goodwill doesn't matter. Yeah. You know when companies impair goodwill, they write off huge amounts. Yeah. You know what the market reaction to an impairment of goodwill is? Zero. Why? Because it happens 2 years after the fact. Because by the time accountants tell you you made a mistake, everybody says, what took you so long? Right?
That doesn't tell you that the goodwill line is wrong. It just tells you that the accountancy process...
No, but I'm saying changes in goodwill don't affect prices. Then the goodwill line item obviously was not factoring into the price, right? Because that's the simplest way to test that proposition. Does goodwill matter? Let's look at big changes in the number. Because if it does matter, when I do write off a 50% of goodwill, you should be surprised by it and say, you know what, that's bad news, I'm going to knock down your price. You look in the marketplace, people don't seem to care. So the it proposition. The second proposition is named after my famous daughter, the one who taught me about dividends and buybacks and the one who taught me about poison pills.
Sorry, question.
Okay. Yes?
Are you saying that there's no value for the brand?
No, that's not what I said. I said the value for your brand comes from where? From pricing power. So if you tell me you have a brand name, and I find out that your margins are lower than everybody else's in the sector, you know what I'm going to come back and ask you? Where did this brand name thing come from? So I've been spending billions of dollars in advertising for the last 50 years. Hey, that's not what drives brand name. If you could spend billions on advertising and have nothing to show for it. So brand name has huge value if it comes with pricing power. In the case of Coca-Cola, out of the $80 billion that I valued Coca-Cola at, this was 10 years ago, $68 billion was brand name. Because you take out the brand name, what are you left with? A crappy syrup. And this is why when people say, would you care about what that recipe is? You can keep the recipe if you give me the brand name. You know why? Go to Mexico and order Coca-Cola. Obviously, it tastes very different from Coca-Cola in the US. The recipe is not what drives the brand name. And for a brief period in 86, remember Coca-Cola forgot this? They played this old Coke, new Coke kind of thing. It's not the taste. Nobody cares. It's your brand name that's allowing you this pricing power, the distribution system, the value. So it has huge value, but it should already be in your numbers. Second proposition. Called the DER proposition. I asked you, some of you, how many have kids? I have four kids. Oh, we have four kids, I have to be very clear. And there's this very strange process we've gone through with all four of them, and maybe you've shared this experience. Around the age of two, your kids think you know everything on the face of the earth. They come to you with questions like, what's the meaning of the universe? Why is the moon out there? And you can make up stuff and they can't really check your answer anyway because they're too young to read Wikipedia. So you kind of make up answers and they say, oh, dad knows so much. Or mom knows so much. And then between the age of two and three, something very insidious happens. They go to sleep one night thinking you know a lot. And the next day they wake up and you know a little less than you did the previous day. And once that gets started, it's downhill from there. You get stupider and stupider and stupider and stupider. And around the age of 16, usually, you've become the stupidest person on the face of the earth, right? For some of you, this might have happened. So this was when my daughter was 16. My sons are too self-involved to even care about this. Daughters usually make you know that you're the stupidest person repeatedly. That's one of the great things about having a daughter. So I love her. So at 16, our positions in the at the kitchen table when we sit down to dinner are always the same thing. Like all families, you have your chair. And I had the singular misfortune of being across the table from my daughter. So dinner would start. We'd have something, topic of conversation would come up. But I thought I had something to contribute. I'd open my mouth. My daughter would look across the table from me and say, "Dad, duh." And the amount of contempt that oozed out of that "duh" was so much. I'd shut my mouth. For 2 years, I did not talk. The good news was, between the age of 17 and 18, one night she went to bed thinking I was the stupidest person, and the next morning when she woke up, I was not as stupid as I was the previous day. So maybe I'm on this uphill climb. I'm not going to get my hopes up. I'm going to become the cleverest person, but maybe I'll become the 10th stupidest person, the 20th. I reserve the "duh" proposition for a subset of emails I get from people valuing companies. Here's how the emails will go. "I'm valuing a money-losing company. I expected to lose money forever. What valuation model will work best in valuing this company?" Wake up. Duh. You're valuing a money-losing company. Expect to lose money forever. Why are you even thinking about paying for this company? They should be paying you. So let's get that out of the road. If your company has negative cash flows in perpetuity, let it go. The third proposition is what I call the "don't freak out" proposition. Every person in my valuation class, 15-week semester. No, it's actually 14 weeks. One of the nice things about Stern is they keep making the semester shorter and shorter and charging the same price, which actually is great for me because my teaching requirements keep narrowing. 14 weeks, they pick a company the first week, and they can pick any company they want. They get to value it over 14 weeks. So after they pick the company the first week, and the second and the third week, quite a few of them will show up in my office. So I have to change companies. "Why? You just picked a company last week?" "Well, I worked out the cash flows for next year, and they're negative." He says, "So?" He says, "Remember the duh proposition?" "I remember it. I just gave you the duh proposition." He says, "Duh proposition says you company negative cash flows have no value." This is what happens when people don't listen all the way through. Because the duh proposition says if your cash flows are negative forever, the value is nothing. But can you have a company where the cash flows are negative up front? Yeah. In fact, if you're a young growth company, your cash flows should be negative. But that's okay as long as you get disproportionately large positive cash flows in the future. Why disproportionately large? You lose $1 billion in year one, you got to get $10 billion back in year 10. In fact, here's a dead giveaway that somebody's playing games with you. They value a young growth company, giving you this huge growth rate. You look at the cash flows, and they're positive right from the beginning. So a Tesla valuation from an equity research report at a major investment bank. Revenue growth, and I had no issue with the revenue growth. Then I look at the cash flows. Positive right from day one. I sent an email to the guy. I said, "I looked at your equity research DCF, D.C.F, just to be clear about what he was told. And I noticed that you seem to be putting in this really high growth rate. But Tesla is an automobile company, right? It has to produce cars. So he'd actually increase the production that Tesla would have to, 800,000 cars by the 10th year. And I said, "I have a little bit of a problem with your cash flows. Where exactly are these cars going to be made?" Right, at least with a technology company, you can claim networking stuff, all kinds of crappy stuff built on each other. You need assembly lines. And to get assembly lines and assembly plants, you've got to invest. Which would show up as a negative cash flow. He actually answered me back. He said, "It slipped my mind." "Slipped your mind? What does that mean?" And then he said, "My buy recommendation wasn't based on the DCF anyway." I said, "Now the truth is coming out. So why do we have this engineered DCF as Exhibit 6 If you were to base it on some multiple of revenues in 2020, why don't we just be make this process more honest and tell me that's what you did? And finally, the value is not price proposition. Let me explain that. Remember the tissue that I gave him with the $20 bill? What if I told you that we're in a city with crazy people, which goes without saying, we're in New York, and that there are people outside this room who are paying $30 right now for tissues with $20 bills in them? Suppose that's true. You see how the game changes for you? You know there's only $20. From an intrinsic value standpoint, you should be paying only $20. But you see how you're going to be tempted to pay 22 or 24 or 25. Why? You get that? You're going to run out as quickly as you can. That's the pricing game. It's a different game. I don't think of it as a bad game. It's a different game. Lots of investors, that's the game they're playing in markets. They're not thinking about what's the value of Tesla. They're saying, if I buy Tesla at 200, can I sell it to somebody else at 220? Different game. Value is not price. So hold on to that thought, because I'm going to go back to something I said very early in the class, which is you're a storyteller. You tell stories about companies. You're a number cruncher. You create models about companies. To me, valuation connects the two. A good valuation tells a story. Every number should have a story behind it, and every story should have a number to attach it to. I just feel this is what I spent my last three long plane flights on, is finishing a book on narrative and numbers, about connecting stories to numbers. It should go off. It will be under some Mexican food item on my website somewhere sooner or later. So keep checking. It's going to show up. The actual book actually is going to be priced at around $15. So if you have $15, you can spend it on that. And essentially what I do is I take companies and I tell a story and I connect the story to the numbers, because that to me is at the core of valuation. This is my pushback against what I see increasingly happening out there, because a lot of valuation is becoming modeling. You know what I mean? They teach you how to do Excel spreadsheets. You become an Excel ninja. So you hit these three buttons. Look, the alternate rows will all change colors. Wow. That makes my valuation so much better. It goes white, yellow, white, yellow, white, yellow. And that's what it's become. It's a lot of modeling instead of storytelling. At the other extreme, if you go to Silicon Valley, they tell stories like they're going out of style, right? Founders, VCs. And I think we need to bring the processes together, because I think both sides are screwing up. They're making some really dangerous mistakes because they're not connected. So with that in mind, let me set up the ingredients of what drive value. The value of a business is driven by the cash flows you generate from your existing assets. Those cash flows can be computed before debt payments or after debt payments. You're saying, who cares? After debt payments, they go to equity. Before debt payments, they go to the business. So that's the first step. What are your cash flows from existing assets? Second, I need to know what growth you're going to be able to generate in these cash flows. And if I'm looking at growth in pre-debt income, I'm looking at growth in operating income. Why? Because I'm valuing the business. But if I'm looking at the equity portion of this business, I might care about earnings per share and net income. So your focus on looking at the company changes depending on whether you're valuing the entire business or just the equity in the business. Then I ask you, what discount rate should I apply to these cash flows? And again, if you're looking at the entire business, your discount rate becomes the cost of capital. Now do you see why I said, once you've taken a corporate finance class, you've already done the dirty work? Because that same cost of capital for Disney of 7.81% I used is now going to play double duty as my discount rate to value the business. But if I'm valuing Disney's equity directly, I'm going to be focusing on the cost of equity. And then at the end of the process, I need to apply closure. What I mean by that is a publicly traded company, at least in theory, can keep going and going and going forever. I can't estimate cash flows forever. I need to stop. And when can I stop? I'm going to ask you to make an assumption that will make you incredibly uncomfortable. You can stop if you're willing to make the assumption that beyond that point in time, your cash flows grow at a constant rate forever. What does that buy you? It buys you that perpetual growth mode. Say, can I use a multiple? If you do, don't call it an intrinsic valuation. It's a pricing. A lot of banking valuations need 6x EBITDA to get the value at the end. But if you do that, it's a pricing put out in the future. It's really not an intrinsic valuation. Those are the drivers of value. And everything we do is driven around getting those numbers. So I'm going to take you on a quick tour of each of those ingredients, cash flows, growth rates, discount rates, the terminal value. And along the way, hopefully, you will start to see that this process is pretty simple if you keep it simple. Let's start with cash flows. I ask you to value a company. The laziest, easiest way to value the company is to just take dividends and say, you know what? It's the only cash flow I get. It's a cash flow, of course, to equity. And the oldest discounted cash flow models out there are dividend discount models. They're built on trust. Trust in what? That companies pay out what they can afford to pay out in dividends. The earliest dividend discount models came out in 1938. They're still around. But as we just went through this process when we talked about dividend policy, most companies don't pay out what they can afford to in dividends. A lot of them pay out less. Some of them pay out more. And we came up with an alternative to dividend, which was the free cash flow equity. And there's an intermediate solution you can take. If you're too lazy to do free cash flow equity, you can say, look, now maybe I can add the buybacks to the dividends. Think of that as augmented dividends. All cash flows to equity, but you have to make a decision as to whether you want to go the distance and compute the potential dividends or whether you want to take these intermediate steps. When you talk about cash flows to the firm, you're talking about a pre-debt cash flow. Why? Because debt is part of the capital of the firm. So what I'm going to start with is the operating income, or the earnings before interest and taxes for the company. Why? Because net income is after interest expenses, so I want to climb the income statement. I'm going to net out the taxes from that operating income. Why? Because I get to keep after-tax cash flows. And then I'm going to do what looks like something strange. I'm going to take some of those earnings and set them aside. To do what? Because I want to grow. I want to reinvest. And I'm going to measure how much I reinvest in two layers. First, I'm going to capture how much I reinvest in long-term assets, land, building, equipment, machinery. And I'm going to capture it as a difference between CapEx and depreciation. That might sound odd. Well, you know, why are you taking the difference? Depreciation, remember, is that accounting expense, but not a cash expense. So depreciation pays for some of my CapEx. This is called net CapEx. It captures what I'm putting into long-term assets. But if I'm a retailer or a grocery and I'm growing, it might be because I'm giving out, my inventory is increasing, so the change in working capital becomes investment in short-term assets. So I start with the after-tax operating income, I subtract those two, I end up with what's called the free cash flow to the firm. Free cash flow to equity is after debt payments, free cash flow to the firm is before. So let's see what this looks like for Disney. Their operating income of $10.03 billion leading into my valuation. Their tax rate, and this is, I think, somebody asked me about, you asked me about effective tax rates, right? This is the place where you can get to use effective tax rates because I'm looking at all my income. When I do cost of debt, because it's the margin, I want to stay with the marginal tax rate. When I look at all my income, I now have the luxury of saying, I do manage taxes well. I pay less in taxes, and this is where I reward you for that lower tax rate. My CapEx, as Disney, was $5.239 billion, and I count acquisitions as part of CapEx. I've never understood why we draw this distinction, because that's the way you grow. And we say, okay, good. I'm going to count your growth from this, but I'm also going to count the cost of those acquisitions. And the depreciation was $2,192 million. And the change in working capital that Disney had during this period, the increase in inventory, was $103 million. So let's work through the numbers. $10.03 billion net of taxes is $6.9 billion. That's the after-tax operating income. Minus reinvestment, $3.6 billion. Minus cash flow, working capital change gives me a free cash flow of about $3.2 billion. On a proportional basis, Disney put back 54% of its after-tax operating income back into the business. Now you're investors in Disney, right? When I put money back into the business, that's less cash flow for you today. So why are you okay with this? Because what do you hope to get in return? So when I put reinvestment, what's the quid pro quo? What do you hope to see in the future? You're going to see growth. Whenever you talk about reinvestment, the twin is growth. Whenever you talk about growth, the twin is reinvestment. Do you see how this keeps us disciplined? Because when you value a company, what do managers say? I try a higher growth rate. Okay. But where is it coming from? By forcing you to think about reinvestment, it keeps you from letting evaluations run away from you. So that's the process of coming up with the cash flow. We're going to build off that. That was last year, right? Yeah.
Sorry, I missed something on the cash flow to the firm. Yeah. Are you using kids after-tax operating income? And on the previous slide, it's EBIT. Having a hard time
to me, after-tax operating income and EBIT times 1 minus T, I use them interchangeably. So EBIT is earnings before interest and taxes. So we climb up the income statement.
Yep.
That's what to me operating income is in most income statements.
You
think about gross income?
Yeah.
So exactly, that's what the 1 minus T is doing. Is acting like I pay taxes in the operating.
And so the interests.
That's good. You brought it up. You're saying where is the tax savings from interest expenses? You know why I don't count that? What do I discount these cash flows back at? I discount them back at the cost of capital. The tax benefit from interest expenses is already in the discount rate, and I don't want to double count it. Okay? So that's my cash flow. Let's talk about discount rates.
The reinvestment fee percentage.
The reinvestment is what you're putting back in the business. It's a growth in assets that you have from year to year because you want to grow in the future. More factories, more plant, more equipment, more land, more buildings. Whatever you're investing in to grow as a company. So the way you notice in the balance sheet would be the change in the balance sheet from year to year. The asset change from year to year. It's what you're adding to the business. Now let's talk about discount rates. Three very simple suggestions. When you value a company, you're valuing it as of right now. Why? It's the only valuation that actually you can act on, right? There's no point telling me what the value of a company was as of January 1st, 2015. Who cares? What are you going to do about it? So when you do your project valuation, try to keep your numbers moving. At least your risk-free rate. I don't mean risk premium might be too much work, but at least look up what the rate is for your currency that you're doing the valuation on at the time of the valuation. So keep it current. Second, keep it consistent. In what sense? If your cash flows are pre-debt cash flows, your discount rate has to be a cost of capital. If your cash flows are post-debt cash flows, your discount rate has to be a cost of equity. If your cash flows are in reais, your discount rate has to be in reais. If your cash flows in pesos, your discount rate has to be in pesos. Don't mismatch. And third, if you look at a typical valuation done anywhere around the world, and you look at where people spend their time, they spend 80% of their time coming up with discount rates, 20% with cash flows. For whatever reason, we get stuck in this discount rate process. It makes us feel comfortable just to be those little details. Should I use 6.31% or 6.25%? 10-year bond rate or 30-year bond rate? Just let it go. In a big valuation, when I screw up on valuations, not an objective I usually have when I go into a valuation, but I do screw up, it's almost always because I got the cash flows wrong. The discount rate is not the place to spend most of your time. Yeah?
In valuation, is there usually a significant part of the value, the terminal value, and on which a wrong discount rate will have a significant effect?
Even there it doesn't, and I'll show you why. The way I do terminal value, it doesn't, and part of the reason the way I do it is to keep it from having too much of an impact. Right? So here's what Disney's current cost of capital looks like, and if it looks... Yeah, that's what I did for the Disney theme park, right? So when I did a project, I do the project cash flows, I do a project cost of capital, I take the present value. So a project valuation is actually much more contained. It's much easier to do, because once a project is done, it's done. The problem with the company is it's a collection of projects that might grow over time and you've got to make judgments.
But what you recommend as a percentage of the discount cash flow?
Of the terminal value? There is no good percentage. Here's why. Why do we invest in equities? No, we invest in a stock in a company. Why do we do it? Or an equity in a project? It's not just for the cash flows, it's for the price appreciation, right? You know what the terminal value captures? How much of your value comes from price appreciation? So let's make this very simple. If you're investing in a mature project, a mature company, maybe 50% of your value will come from the terminal value. Why? Because you get a lot of cash flows. If you invest in a growth company, 80% of your value is going to come from the terminal value. If you invest in a startup, 125% can come from terminal value. You think, how can it be more than 100%? Because those negative cash flows, you'll be issuing equity along the way. So, and again, this is one reason I push back against rules of thumb, because I've seen, you know, like KPMG in one part of the world actually has this rule for analysts that terminal value should not exceed 75%. And the contortions these poor guys have to go through to meet that constraint. Not only does it take a lot of work, but it actually takes away from the valuation. There is no rule of thumb that's going to apply because it depends on the project. On the Disney theme park, it turns out that it's big because it's a really long-term investment, but would it be a 15-year investment? I mean, less so. So cost of capital for Disney at their existing debt ratio. But there's a little problem here, right? Because we said their optimal was 40%. He's saying, how come you're not using the optimal? Because Bob Iger is running the company. I'm not. This is the difference between valuation and corporate finance. In valuation, what do you say? I'm looking at the company from the outside in, and I'm saying these guys don't like to borrow money, so I'm going to keep the debt ratio at what it is, even though I might feel differently. And that cost of capital of 7.81% is what we estimated yesterday when we talked about hurdle rates for investment. So it's the same cost of capital now coming back into my valuation as my discount rate. Here's the one thing I do differently with companies than with projects. When I sit down to value a company, if it's a high growth company, as I go through on my spreadsheet, what am I doing to this company? I'm making that become a more mature company, growth rates decrease. I'm taking it on my spreadsheet from high growth to a mature status, right? So hang in there with me. As I go from high growth to mature status, think about each aspect of the cost of capital. Early on in this process, when I'm high growth, what might I see as a beta, a high beta or a low beta? Probably going to see a high beta. Probably going to see a low debt ratio. Why? Because I can't afford. So initially, when I value the company, I'm going to see all equity funded, high risk company. But on my spreadsheet, by the time I get to year 10, I'm making this company a mature company with lots of earnings. So what should happen? The beta should come down. The debt ratio should reflect that of a mature company. Your cost of capital should actually change over time. It's one thing that I've never understood why people are so resistant to doing, because they're so stuck on one cost of capital in evaluation that they don't want to seem to open the door to, hey, the cost of capital can change. In this case, the change is relatively small for Disney because its beta is already 1. Its debt ratio is already 12%. But you know, the cost of capital for Disney goes from 7.81, it does change, to 7.29% as I take them from this phase when I give them growth all the way down to stable growth. So my cash flows are going to be cash flows before debt minimum. My cost of capital now becomes my discount rate. Let's talk about growth. The one thing that I think gets our valuations into trouble is when growth becomes an exogenous input. You know what an exogenous input is? Basically, it's a number, 10%, let's write 12, 14. You got to tie growth back to what a company does. And algebraically, the growth in a company is a product of two things: how much it reinvests and how well it reinvests. And how I measure those two numbers will be different depending on whether I'm looking at equity growth or operating income growth. For operating income growth, I'm going to look at how much you reinvest with that net capex and change in working capital as my reinvestment, as a percentage of my after-tax operating income. With equity, I'm going to be looking at more traditional retention ratios. How much are you not paying out as dividends? If you ask me how well am I reinvesting, I'm going to be looking at the return on capital you earn as a company. I look at equity, the return I'm making is based on the return equity. Your focus is actually very different depending on what you're doing. In the case of Disney, do you remember what their return on capital was? It's an unfair question. Actually, that's pretty close. It was 12.81% in the risk computer. The reinvestment rate I computed for them just a few pages ago was 53.93%. You already see why my work's already done for me. If you ask me how quickly will Disney grow in the future, if it maintains that reinvestment rate from last year, and this return on capital, its expected growth rate for the next, for the period that it can maintain these numbers is going to be about 6.8% a year. So let's say I present this to Disney managers, and they say, that looks too low. I'd like 9%. What do I have to push back on? To get to a 9% growth rate, there are two ways they can get there. One is, reinvest more. I say, we can't do that. We have to pay dividends. We have to buy back stock. I say, okay. Are you going to reinvest better? Yes, 17%. If your return on capital. And they say, yes. Then I'm saying, well, you've never had a 17% return on capital in the last 25 years. What's going to be? You've got to shift the focus back to businesses. Now, you have to earn growth. And that's why it's so difficult to deliver high quality growth for long periods. Because you've got to maintain both these numbers, reinvestment rate and return on capital, at high values. Which brings me to that elephant in the room, the terminal value. It's pointed out. This is the bulk of the value of a company. It comes from the terminal value. And we need it because otherwise we can't have closure. Now, if you look at the equation for terminal value, it's a perpetual growth equation. Basically, to get the terminal value in year 10, I have to get the cash flow in year 11 divided by R minus G. Take a look at that equation. Look at the denominator. See, R minus G, right? This is the place you're going to go if you want to make the value of your company go through the roof. Why? Because all you need to do is take the G and start moving it towards R. And as you move towards R, you are going to get a Buzz Lightyear valuation to infinity and beyond. That's where you're going, because as G hits R, that's exactly where we're going. This is the scariest part of valuations, and people start playing games with the terminal value. So I'm going to give you four very simple rules to both make sure this doesn't happen to you, and more importantly, make sure it doesn't get done to you. So the next time you see a DCF valuation, here are the four things I want you to focus on, because at some point in time, you have to make this judgment of putting your company to stable growth, and that's a judgment call you're going to make. So if you're a company with a small company in a big market, say, I'm going to wait 10 years, I'm going to wait 15 years, I'm okay with that. But here are the four rules I'm going to suggest. First is, that growth rate forever cannot be greater than the growth rate of the economy in which you operate. Might as well state the obvious. But I'm actually going to make it even more rigid. And I'm going to draw on a rule that I came up with yesterday as my proxy for growth rate in the economy. Do you remember that? When I did my implied equity risk premium, I said, not just inflation, I said I'm going to use my risk-free rate as my proxy for growth rate in perpetuity. You know why I do this? Right now, we talk about risk-free rates being too low. Maybe we're all right. Maybe that's true, that central bank. I want to make sure that your growth rate also stays low, because if I let you use whatever growth rate you want and you use a low risk-free rate, your valuation is going to blow up. So respect the cap. And you know how much pushback you will get on this? People will say, but this company is special. Can't we let it go a little above the growth rate? That's like being a little bit pregnant. It's you either are or you aren't, right? This is one of the things. You break the rule, you've broken the rule. So don't let it happen. Right? Second, remember, to grow, you've got to reinvest. So when you tell me in year 10 your company is going to be a mature company, you've got to tell me what kind of return you expect this company to make after year 10. I'll tell you what I assume for Disney. For the next 5 years, I think they can make 12.61%, well above their cost of capital. Why? Because I see barriers to entry, competitive advantages. But I also know, given my looking at mature companies over time, that as you go through time, that gap is going to get smaller. In fact, there are outfits like McKinsey that actually make it zero. For mature companies, they say the excess return, what you make over your cost of capital, should go to zero. I'm not willing to go that far, but I'm going to push the return on capital down to 10% by the time I get to year 10. So Disney, as it gets more mature, is going to see its return on capital drift down. I gave it the cost of capital of a mature company. Basically, I adjusted the cost of capital reflected. And the final piece of this puzzle, is I compute how much they need to reinvest by taking the growth rate, which I said at 2.5% for Disney, below the risk-free rate, and dividing it by my return on capital. So starting in year 11, you know what you're going to see? You're going to see Disney reinvest 25% of its after-tax operating income every year in perpetuity. Question? Yeah? Hey, do you have your hand up?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Talking about reinvesting, if, for example,
a firm takes on finance lease. A finance lease. That's a debt decision. That's not an investment decision. So basically, borrowed
money. Balance sheet, liability increases.
And there's going to be a counter asset, right? So that store you got with a financial lease will become, that's a reinvestment that year.
So
that will be part of your reinvestment that year.
But the company, you call that reinvestment?
Yeah. Why not? If you're a retailer, how do you grow? You get another store, you lease it. You add another store, you lease it. So that's how you grow. I count that cost as part of your reinvestment. And then I look at your earnings and hope your earnings go up enough to cover that reinvestment.
Because firms will actually do this, enter into sales, buy back,
That's a financing decision you made. If that's the cheaper way for you to get that additional store, who am I to come in and say you shouldn't do that? So as long as you're not playing games with me, that is part of my reinvestment as well, just as much as it would be if I borrowed money and bought that store. So reinvestment in my world is a much broader concept than it is in most economies. So now I'm going to put closure here. So you got the cash flows, you got the discount rate, the terminal value, you discount them all back. What do you get? If you're discounting dividends, you're done. This is your value per share. If you're discounting cash flows to equity, the cost of equity, what you've got is the value of equity in the aggregate. You're saying, what does that even mean? If you've granted equity options, this is your last chance. You've got to subtract those out. If you're discounting cash flows to the firm at the cost of capital, there's a whole host of trouble waiting for you. And here's why. You valued the operating assets of the company, right? Why? Because you used to operating income. What have you not valued? Any asset whose income is not part of operating income has not been valued yet. So what's not been valued yet for Apple? I haven't valued the cash. So I've got that's $200 billion. That's not penny change. What have I not valued at Yahoo when I do this? I haven't valued Yahoo Japan and Alibaba. You think, how big a difference can it make? You visit my blog, I actually did a valuation of Yahoo. I came up with a $5 billion value for Yahoo. That's the value of Yahoo's operating as. What is that? That's a search engine that nobody uses. And a mail that only old people use. $5 billion. And then I valued Alibaba and I came up with $22 billion. For just their holding of Alibaba. And I valued their 35% holding of Yahoo Japan and I came up with another $13 billion. So Yahoo as a company is worth $40 billion, but only $5 billion of it comes from its operating assets. That's what I valued. These cross holdings that I have haven't been valued yet. And that's part of the reason I thought it was so unlikely that Marissa Mayer could ever turn the company around. Why? Because what did we give it? What did she control? The $5 billion, right? And when I wrote the post on it, people took it the wrong way. But I said, on any given day at Yahoo, the value of Yahoo as a company is driven more by what Jack Ma is doing at Alibaba than Marissa Mayer is doing at Yahoo. So it's a harsh statement, but that's a reality. You're controlling the rump of the company. The main part of the company is coming from those cross holdings. So you've got to add cash, you've got to add cross holdings, you've got to subtract out debt. And this is your last chance to mop up. You have a lawsuit that's out there. You have to take the effect of what that will do to your value. And what you get at the end will be the value of equity in the company. You divide by the number of shares, you get a value of equity per share. It's not a difficult process, but you got to go sequentially. You can't jump steps. You got to go each step. You got to make sure, look around to see if you've got everything you need. So in the case of Disney, I gave them a 10-year period to get to steady state. In the first 5 years, you know what I assume? That they'd continue to be run by Bob Iger the way he's run it for the last 3 years. Same return on capital, same. So the first 5 years was easy. After year 10, I make them a mature company. I give them a 2.5% growth rate, and basically I list it up. Yeah?
Just a question. What are your thoughts on the tax implications for Yahoo?
I think that's part of the problem. Yahoo is a dead man walking, right? Basically, the problem is you can't. It's like, did you see The Walking Dead, the TV show? Last summer I got hooked on this. It's the most gory show ever, like 15,000 people die every 5 minutes. But Yahoo reminds me of a Walking Dead company, which is the... Oh, that's your next stop after Groupon? You're welcome, right? And here's the problem that you're going to run into with Yahoo. You're saying, well, if it's Yahoo Japan, Alibaba, and Yahoo is the operating asset is shrinking, why don't we just liquidate the company? The problem they face is, the Alibaba investment was made in 2005 at $1 billion. Now it's worth $22 billion. So if we liquidate the company, what's going to happen? They have to pay taxes. And that's the problem that Yahoo faces is, you almost, and my suggestion is they leave it as a holding company. Basically two holdings. In fact, my suggestion was even crueler. I said, let's get Marissa. Two TV displays, reduce the number of employees at Yahoo to one. She can be the employee. And every morning she comes in and she watches the two displays. And one, she will see the price of Yahoo Japan, and the other, the price of Alibaba, and she watches all day and then goes back home. Because that's what it's going to become, right? You're going to be a reflection. And somebody asked me, why would I buy Yahoo? You know why? Because I'm getting Alibaba at a 29% discount when I buy Yahoo, if they don't do anything stupid. That's right. If they liquidate, that 29% might be the tax, but they don't have to, right? It could be. So that's why I'm saying don't liquidate. Leave it as a holding company. Nothing. Nobody has to liquidate the company. Leave it as a holding company. It'll be my vehicle for investing in Yahoo Japan and Alibaba at a discount. So these are the assumptions. So basically, you, after year 10, I make them a stable growth company. In the middle, the year 6 through 10, you know how I come up with the numbers? Basically, it's just a linear interpolation. So basically, my growth rate is 6.8 for the first 5 years and 2.5 after year 11. I just go step by step. You see, that's so unsophisticated. It's not going to make much difference in value. Reserve your fights for where it makes a difference. This isn't the place it is. So when you see my valuation of Disney, you're seeing the end product of all of these assumptions play out. There's a story I'm telling about Disney in this valuation, right? What's the story I'm telling? It's a company that's going to continue to be run as a mature entertainment company where managers don't like to borrow as much as they can. But they do have these significant comparative advantages, the brand name that they'll be able to exploit at least in the near term. What could ruin the story? The entertainment business implodes from inside. That's the Netflix Amazon threat to the entertainment business, right? That this business could implode from the inside, in which case the numbers are going to start melting down on earnings and cash flows. But it's not because your modeling skills are bad, but because you're missing a big part of the story. That's what I mean about every valuation having a story. In fact, I'm going to, if I took that valuation, I can actually swivel it and make it, you know those three principles, the investment principles? I could actually teach this class going backwards. Don't worry, I'm not planning on doing this. Essentially, start with the valuation. We could do everything we did in this class because somewhere in this valuation is a number that came from everything we've talked about. You talk about great projects, it shows up as a return on capital. You talk about debt ratios, it shows up through the cost of capital. You talk about dividend policy, it shows up through the reinvestment rate. Everything we talk about in corporate finance is somewhere in this value. So keep that in mind as you go through this process because if you say, look, I could run this company differently, you now have the tools to do it, right? You could go change the debt ratio, change the way they reinvest, and you could revalue the company. In fact, the value that I got for Disney was $62 with the existing guys running it. Then I said, you know what? I'm going to run the company. I'm going to change the debt ratio to 40%. Why 40? Because that was my optimal. And when I did that, the value that I got for the company is $74.91. 62.26, 74.91. The difference is about $12.65. There's your value of control, which coincidentally happens to be close to 20%. So maybe these bankers are onto something. But I don't think so, because in this case, it's pure coincidence. But the value of the company is that shift. This is not part of your project, but if you decide to do a valuation of the company, build it on a story. And I'll give you my feedback on the valuation. It won't affect your grade. So if you want to value the company and send me the valuation, I'll be glad to take a look and say, what's your story here? And I'll push you on story, because when I see a number, I'll say, what's your story behind this number? Because that's what makes valuation work.
Can you help with the capstone?
What exactly are you doing in the capstone? I kind of disassociate myself with everything with Trima after I walk out of this room. Yeah? But the capstone is this big project you have to do.
We have another company that we are evaluating. Can I send to you?
Sure.
You
as long as the company is not a money-losing company, expect to lose money forever.
Okay.
In which case, I'll save you the trouble right now. Sure, I'd be glad to. No? Yeah.
Question. Is there any case when the valuation depends on the perspective of the investor?
I'll tell you when it matters. If you're a passive investor, what are you going to stop? You're going to stop at the 62.25. If you're Bill Ackman or Carl Icahn, you are going to value control. Why? Because that's why you invest. Okay. So that's the way the perspective of the investor is going to kick into the process. What can you change about the company? Many of us, we can't.
If I'm bringing it private, like Michael
right.
Dell buying...
You still have to tell me what you're going to do once you go private.
Should I change the
total beta? No. Because if you go private, What's your plan? If you succeed, what's your plan? You want to go public again. No company at this size goes private
forever.
You're doing it, taking private to fix it. Couple of final things. This, of course, is the big picture you've seen before, but there are three things I want you to leave you with. It's the first time ever in a Triumph class that I've actually finished the whole packet. I don't know how that happened, especially since we lost about 30 minutes today, but you guys must be really brilliant. Right? Three things that I want to leave you with that I leave every one of my classes with. First, if you go to my website, you will actually see all my classes are carried pretty much live. They're on iTunes U. I use YouTube as well in case you... So every lecture that I do, it's not live because it's recorded, but about the same... So starting Monday, I'm going to be teaching the undergraduate corporate finance class of 28 sessions. Every class will be available online with the lecture notes. I even put the quizzes, so you can take the quiz, grade yourself with the grading template. The only thing you will not have is any credit or... But it's free. Right? And this semester, I'm actually going to be, for NYU, we're going to be developing a valuation certificate around the class. So this is the first time we're going to be doing an online certificate program, which will be online classes, but with stuff to test you on. But at the end, you get a certificate. So it will, of course, cost money. It's an NYU, it's not going to be free, but that's not my problem. Second, don't take any of this stuff too seriously. Remind yourself it's only money. And I'm reminded about 5 or 6 years ago, maybe even more than that, second year MBA student, I finished my valuation class, she comes up to me. She was a history major from Yale who came back for an MBA program. And if you're a history major from Yale, you usually take that route where you never see a number for 2 years. But it's you. Yeah? It can happen. You can do it at the best of schools. You can just go through 2 years, never see a number. Lots of cases. She comes to the end of the class and she said, I never thought this would happen, but I have a job as a sell-side equity research analyst. I said, congratulations. She said, I'm really scared. I said, what are you so scared about? She said, what if I make a mistake? I said, be glad you're not a brain surgeon. Make a mistake, somebody dies on the table. You make a mistake, what's the worst that's going to happen? Somebody gets a little richer. Somebody else gets a little poorer. Just make sure that somebody who gets a little poorer is not you. Just think like a Marxist. You move some wealth around, the world hasn't ended, move on. Nothing in corporate finance and valuation is worth losing sleep over. So somebody really wants to use a regression beta? It's Saturday at 10 o'clock at night. What the hell are you doing fighting back saying bottom-up beta? Let them use the regression beta. Let it go. And finally, if you're ever given a choice between understanding everything there is to understand about corporate finance and being lucky, which one should you pick? Just pick being lucky. This is a business where the dominant paradigm is luck. We can't tell you this. This is a business school. We're selling this package of, if you get these skills, if you're lucky, it doesn't really matter what you do. You can be crap, and you can do crappy stuff, it'll still pay off. If you're not lucky, you can do everything right and nothing is going to pay off. Something brought home to me by my mother-in-law when she came to visit in early 2000. And my mother-in-law became an avid investor in the 1990s, which to me should have been a sign that the market was topping off. Mother-in-law, big investor, get out of the market now. Kind of missed that sign. And she would drive us crazy. She'd turn on CNBC, she'd watch it all day. She made it a spectator sport. Go, Cisco, go. It was like, look, it went up an eighth, another quarter. And all day long, all she would talk about what was in her portfolio, what was out of her portfolio, what she wished was in, what she wished was out. And I had to act like I was listening. That's what son-in-laws do. But then she let it slip that she owned Qualcomm, one of the great stocks of 99, up 600%. And I was impressed. I asked her, Judy, why did you pick Qualcomm? I knew the minute I asked this question, I shouldn't have. But she told me. She said she picked Qualcomm because it owned MCI. I said, that's not Qualcomm, that's WorldCom. She says, Qualcomm, what's the difference? I said, if you bought the stock, you really meant to buy it. I've lost 30%, so you're buying some other stock that rhymes so that it makes 600%. I was afraid to ask her after that why she owns Cisco, afraid the answer might be, I really like their vegetable oil. But after she left, I did try a strategy. I'd pick a stock of the news, pick one that rhymes with it. You know what? If I'd made a lot of money, forget about this intrinsic value cash flow stuff. My next book would have been the rhyming stock strategy. But unfortunately, it didn't work for me. So I wish you the very best. And you will hear from me repeatedly at least until February 29th.
Yeah.
I will harass you, nag you. Tell you all your project is, you'll start like Monday, I will start the harassment. So it's not going to end until February 29th. I'm not going to give you a break because you're going to forget everything by next weekend. So the sooner I hit you, the better off I am. So you will hear from me, and my email address, I'm the easiest person in the world to find. Partly because I bought my own name and it was cheap. Somebody tried to sell me my own name a few weeks ago. Aswadthemodern.com. You want it for $5,000, I said, you can keep it. So don't type the whole name, just type demodern.com, you'll be my website, so anything you want to say.
So just a question, throughout your brilliant, brilliant session over the last 3 days, you had slides in there which was application test. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming
those are your project. Those are your project parts. I will actually put together something that's, because the problem with going through the slides and finding them is that on page 23, then 87, then 96, So what I'm actually going to do is pull that together in one packet. On Monday when you get your email, you see the attachment that lays out the template for what's involved. I'll also give you a link on, here's the way I want you to think about it. This is not a collection of numbers or models that I want you to deliver, because there's actually the number checker spreadsheet that's on the link. We'll already do the number crunching for you. You enter the numbers from your Bloomberg, it'll do the whole, you say, what do I have to do? You have to read the numbers. So what I'd like you to do is think about sitting across the table from the CEO of this company with no consequences to worry about. And that's why I made it some other company rather than the one you work for.
My client.
And tell, and that's fine, so yeah. And tell that CEO what you think the company does well, what you think it does badly, and how it can change from a corporate plan standpoint. That might seem like hubris. You're saying, I don't know the business, I don't know the company, I just started this process. It doesn't matter. You've got to start somewhere. So think of the report as, that's what I want you to see, is not just your optimal is 35%. I want you to tell me, should I go to the 35%? Okay? So think of the numbers as your fulcrum for writing the narrative for this company, the story you're going to tell about the company, what you want me to do. And That's pretty much what the project report is about. It's not a number crunching exercise, because I've essentially set up the infrastructure where the number crunching will get done for you once you enter the numbers for your company. So view this as an exercise in taking those numbers and telling me what to do as a company.
So we act as a CEO of the company, or?
No, it's an easier job. You actually just tell the CEO what he's supposed to do as a CEO of the company. So actually you can walk up. So act like a consultant.
Yeah.
So that's why I said it's an easier job. Let him do the dirty work. If you got to cut costs, walk out of the door. Then he says, yes, he actually cut the costs. Yeah.
The McKinsey's involved.
Yeah.
You had one question over there.
Yes.
Thank you so much. It helped me do so much fun. I think both myself and the class would appreciate your quick view on the current state of the U.S. market and the turmoil, and maybe emerging market as a whole, sort of investment geography.
Okay.
The future of it.
I think at the core of this problem is China. And you can't run away from it. And in a sense, for 10 years, we've benefited from China. So in a sense, it's a little unfair to say they're the problem, because for 10 years, we've kind of coasted on China. But remember one of those cards? One of the 3x5 cards I used to use until last year was China. You put it in the envelope, $20 with China in there, was $50. And companies have done this, right? What are you going to do? I'm going to go to China. Now we're seeing the consequences of building so much of the global economy. Let's face it, over the last 10 years, you know that 60% of the real growth in the global economy has come from China. So we've built this huge edifice in China, and now, in a sense, the law of large numbers is kicking in on them, right? So it was never realistic to assume that China could keep growing at double-digit levels. Why? Because it's one thing to do it when they're the eighth largest economy, maybe the fifth. But now you're the second largest economy. But a year ago, I said, mathematically, for the next 10 years, you're better off assuming a 5% real growth in China than 10. And that's an optimistic number just because it's scaled up. And I remember getting Globex saying, what, China's on a 10% real growth path? I said, it's not, you can't do it at this size. And part of what's catching up in China is the reality that they're a much bigger economy, and that what's more realistic is a 4 to 5% real growth rate. But here's the problem. The Chinese government is built, part of their legitimacy with the Chinese people comes from this perception that they can deliver almost anything, whether it's the Olympics or 10% growth. That's what's given them the power. And for them now to say, look, it'll be only 5%, opens doors, which are political doors. This is not even an economic problem. So for the next year or two, you're going to see this back and forth. But I think we have to almost recalibrate our growth expectation, not just for China, but for the global economy. And remember I showed you Vale. And so across the world, you have these companies that have put 35% of their revenues into China. All those companies are going to. So I think this year you're going to see earnings surprises that are more negative than positive flowing out of commodities and China. And I think the commodity problem comes out of the China problem. Because what you're essentially taking out is that 10-year infrastructure building is now behind us. So I think that, like all pain, it is going to take a while to work itself through. I'm not going to freak out or panic. Because at this stage, what can I do? Right. There's no place to hide. There's no place to hide from this. So you've got to ride this out as best as you can and hope that you don't go bankrupt before the Triumph MBA program ends. And if you do, can you claim limited liability and refuse to pay your last tuition? Try it out. No. Or offer to pay with bird droppings. Yeah.
Do you think the commodities down cycle concern is coming more from a supply side concern or a demand side?
I think it's both, because in a sense, I think we can talk about how much production of oil, but one leads the other, right? So what happened was for 10 years, I remember when I first started working with oil companies 30 years ago, what they used to use as a normalized oil price when they made exploration decisions, production decisions, was $20 to $25. From the mid-80s all the way through 2003, that's what they used. And then you got year after year after year, and through that decade, that normalized oil price kept climbing, 25. And the way this shows up is then they made exploration and production decisions in 2008 and 2009 with a $60 price. That's the supply glut, right? Because in a sense, all those shale oil reserves that you said are great reserves are built on that presumption. Oil prices go back to 27. You're not going to shut those reserves down because, in a sense, it's a sunk cost issue. You're not going to get the money back. So this is a part of the commodity problem, is the supply adjustment takes a while. So I wouldn't hold my breath saying any day now the oil production is going to come down. It's going to take a long time for it to adjust, which means there might be a $20 oil price before you see a $50 oil price. Yes.
It's a historical Disney question, but I was wondering now, they bought ESPN through that bad acquisition in 94.
This is how you get lucky, right?
Yeah.
Because actually Michael Eisner did not want ESPN in that Cap Cities acquisition. Mm. He said, why do you want this rump business? Who wants a sports network that nobody watches? Because ESPN was, sometimes you get lucky for the wrong reasons, right? This is why it's better. It's better to be lucky than good. It reinforces that point.
Thank you so much.
Thank